places. Before anyone has a chance to figure out whether Kazmir will get to the Mets, the draft begins. As it does, the Oakland A's owner, Steve Schott, enters the room, followed shortly by the A's manager, Art Howe. Howe stands in the back of the room with his jaw jutting and a philosophical expression on his face, the way he does in the dugout during games. It is one of the mysteries of baseball that people outside it assume the manager is in charge of important personnel decisions. From the start to the end of this process, Howe has been, as he is with all personnel decisions, left entirely in the dark. The A's scouting director, Eric Kubota, takes up his position at the speakerphone and tells everyone else to shut up. Everyone in the draft room is about to learn just how new and different is the Oakland A's scientific selection of amateur baseball players. The A's front office has a list, never formally written out, of the 20 players they'd draft in a perfect world. That is, if money were no object and 29 other teams were not also vying to draft the best amateur players in the country. The list is a pure expression of the new view of amateur players. On it are 12 hitters and 8 pitchers. All, for the moment, just names. Pitchers: Jeremy Guthrie, Joe Blanton, Jeff Francis, Luke Haggerty, Ben Fritz, Robert Brownlee, Stephen Obenchain, Bill Murphy. Position players: Nick Swisher, Russ Adams, Khalil Green, John McCurdy, Mark Tian, Jeremy Brown, Steve Stanley, John Baker, Mark Keeger, Brian Stavisky, Sean Larkin, Brant Colomarino. Two of the position players, Khalil Green and Russ Adams, Billy already knew would be gone before the A's picked, and so he hadn't even bothered to discuss them during the meetings. His best friend, J.P. Ricciardi, would take Adams, and another close friend, Kevin Towers, the GM of the San Diego Padres, would take Green. Two of the pitchers, Robert Brownlee and Jeremy Guthrie, were represented by the agent Scott Boras. Boras was famous for extracting more money than other agents for amateur players. If the team didn't pay whatever Boras asked, Boras would encourage his client to take a year off of baseball and re-enter the draft the following year, when he might be selected by a team with real money. The effect of Boras's tactics on rich teams was astonishing. In 2001, the agent had squeezed a package worth $9,500,000 out of Texas Rangers owner Tom Hicks for a college third baseman named Mark Teixeira. The guy who was picked ahead of Teixeira signed for $4.2 million, and the guy who was picked after him signed for $2.65 million, and yet somehow between these numbers, Boras found $9.5 million. By finding the highest bidders for his players before the draft and scaring everyone else away from them, Boras was transforming the draft into a pure auction. Billy couldn't afford auctions. He had $9.5 million to spend, and Boras had let it be known that whichever team drafted Jeremy Guthrie was going to cough up a package worth $20 million, or Guthrie would return to Stanford for his senior year. The Cleveland Indians had agreed to pay the price, and so the Indians would take Guthrie with the 22nd pick. Of the 16 players on his list he could afford and stood any chance of getting, Billy thinks he might land as many as 6. But the truth is, he doesn't know. It was possible he'd only get one of the players on the wish list. By the time the A's made their second pick, the 24th of the draft, all of them might be gone. If they got 6 of the players on their wish list, Paul said, they'd be ecstatic. No team ever came away with 6 of their top 20. The room remains silent. The entire draft takes place over speakerphone, far away from the fans. In the draft, Major League Baseball has brought to life Bill James's dystopic vision of closing the stadium to the fans and playing the game in private. Pro football and pro basketball make great public event of their drafts. They gather their famous coaches and players in a television studio and hand them paddles with big numbers on them to wave. Football and basketball fans are able to watch the future of their team unfold before their eyes. The Major League Baseball draft is a conference call, now broadcast on the web. The Pittsburgh Pirates, owners of the worst regular season record in the 2001 season, have the first overall pick. A voice from Pittsburgh crackles over the speakerphone. Redraft number 0090, Bullington Bryan, right-handed pitcher, Ball State University, Fishers, Indiana. Just like that, the first $4 million is spent, but at least it is spent on a college player. Redraft means he has been drafted before. The next five teams among the most pathetic organizations in pro baseball select high school players. Tampa Bay takes a high school shortstop named Melvin Upton. Cincinnati followed by taking a high school pitcher named Chris Grueler. Baltimore follows suit with a high school pitcher named Adam Loewen. Montreal follows suit with yet another high school pitcher named Clinton Everts. The selections made are, from the A's point of view, delightfully mad. Eight of the first nine teams select high schoolers. The worst teams in baseball, the teams that can least afford for their draft to go wrong, have walked into the casino, ignored the odds, and made straight for the craps table. Billy and Paul no longer think of the draft as a crapshoot. They are a pair of card counters at the blackjack tables. They think they've found a way to turn the odds inside the casino against the owner. They think they can take over the casino. Each time a team rolls the dice on a high school player, Billy punches his fist in the air. Every player taken that he doesn't want boosts his chances of getting one he does want. And when the Milwaukee Brewers take Prince Fielder with the eighth pick, the room explodes. It means that Scott Kazmir probably will be available to the Mets. And he is. And the Mets take him. And spend $2.15 million to sign him. 16 minutes into the draft, Eric Kubota leans into the speakerphone, trying and nearly succeeding to sound cool and collected. Oakland selects Swisher, Nicholas, first baseman slash center fielder, Ohio State University, Parkersburg, West Virginia, son of ex-major leaguer Steve Swisher. Prince Fielder just saved our paint, says an old scout. Even the fat players who don't work for the A's do the A's work. Billy is now on his feet. He's got Swisher in the bag. Who else can he get? There's a new thrust about him, an unabridged expression on his face. He was a bond trader who had made a killing in the morning and entered the afternoon free of fear, feeling greedy, certain that the fear in the market would present him with even more opportunities to exploit. Whatever happened now wasn't going to be bad. How good could it get? The anger is gone, lingering only as an afterthought in other people's minds. He was no longer in the batter's box. He was out in center field, poised to make a spectacular catch no one expected him to make. Billy's a shark, J.P. Ricciardi had said, by way of explaining what distinguished Billy from every other GM in the game. It's not just that he's smarter than the average bear. He's relentless, the most relentless person I have ever known. Billy moves back and forth between his wish list and Paul and Eric. Paul to check his judgments, Eric to execute his wishes. Like any good bond trader, he loves making decisions. The quicker, the better. He looks up at the names of the players on the whiteboard and listens to the speakerphone crackle. Three pitchers from the wish list, Francis, Brownlee, and Guthrie, go quickly. 16 players that he badly wants to own remain at large. The A's second first-round pick is number 24, paid to them by the Yankees for the right to buy Jason Giambi, followed rapidly by number 26, number 30, number 35, number 37, number 39. Billy has agreed with Eric and Paul to use number 24 to get John McCurdy, a shortstop from the University of Maryland, the second hitter on the wish list. McCurdy was an ugly-looking fielder with the highest slugging percentage in the country. They'd turn him into a second baseman where his fielding would matter less. Billy thought McCurdy might be the next Jeff Kent. The White Sox come on the line. Here goes Blanton, says Billy. When Kenny Williams told Billy an hour before that the White Sox were taking Blanton, Billy couldn't but agree that it showed disturbingly good judgment. Blanton was the second-best pitcher in the draft, in Billy's view, behind Stanford pitcher Jeremy Guthrie. A White Sox voice crackles on the speakerphone. The White Sox selects redraft number 0103, Ring Roger, left-handed pitcher, San Diego State University, La Mesa, California. You fucking gotta be kidding me, hollers Billy, overjoyed. He doesn't pause to complain that Kenny Williams had told him he was taking Blanton. Was he afraid Billy might take Ring? Ring over Blanton? A reliever over a starter? Then it dawns on him. Blanton's going to get to us. The second-best right-handed pitcher in the draft. He says it, but he can't quite believe it. He looks at the board and recalculates what the GMs with the next 5 picks will do. You know what? He says in a surer tone. Blanton's going to be there at 24. Blanton and Swisher, says Eric. That's a home run. The Giants won't take McCurdy, right? Says Billy. The San Francisco Giants had the 25th pick, the only pick between the A's next two. Take Blanton with 24 and McCurdy with 26. Swisher and Blanton and McCurdy, says Eric. This is unfair. He clicks the button on the speakerphone and his voice shaking like a man calling in to say he holds the winning lotto ticket, takes Blanton with the 24th pick, pauses while the Giants make their pick, then takes McCurdy with the 26th. Everyone in the room, even the people in the back who have no real idea what is going on, a group that includes both the manager and the owner of the Oakland A's, claps and cheers. The entire room assumes that if Billy gets what he wants, it can only be good for the future of the franchise. This is now the Billy Bean Show, and it's not over yet. Billy stares at the board. Fritz, he says. It'd be unbelievable if we could get Fritz, too. Benjamin Fritz, right-handed pitcher from Fresno State. Third-best right-handed pitcher in the draft, in Billy's view. There's no chance Tien's gone before 39, right? Says Paul quickly. He can see what Billy is doing. Having realized that he can get most of the best hitters, Billy is now seeing if he can also get the best pitchers, too. Paul's view, the objective one, is that the hitters are a much better bet than the pitchers. He thinks the best thing to do with pitchers is draft them in bulk, lower down. He doesn't want to risk losing his hitters. Tien will be there at 39, says Billy. No one else in the room is willing to confirm it. Take Fritz with 30, Brown with 35, and Tien with 37, Billy says. Eric leans into the speakerphone and listens. The Arizona Diamondbacks take yet another high school player with the 27th pick, and the Seattle Mariners take another with the 28th. The Astros take a college player, not Fritz, with the 29th. Eric takes Fritz with the 30th. We just got two of the three best right-handed pitchers in the country and two of the four best position players, says Paul. This doesn't happen, says Billy. Don't think this is normal. As the 35th pick approaches, Eric once again leans into the speakerphone. If he leaned in just a bit more closely, he might hear phones around the league clicking off so that people could laugh without being heard. For they do laugh. They will make fun of what the A's are about to do, and there will be a lesson in that. The inability to envision a certain kind of person doing a certain kind of thing because you've never seen someone who looks like him do it before is not just a vice. It's a luxury. What begins as a failure of the imagination ends as a market inefficiency. When you rule out an entire class of people from doing a job simply by their appearance, you are less likely to find the best person for the job. Oakland selected redraft number 1172, Brown, Jeremy, catcher, University of Alabama, Hueytown, Alabama. When asked which current or former Major League player Jeremy Brown reminded him of, Paul stewed for 2 days and finally said he has no equivalent. The kid himself is down in Tuscaloosa listening to the webcast of the conference call, biting his nails because he still doesn't quite believe that the A's will take him in the first round. He's told no one except his parents and his girlfriend, and them he's made swear they won't tell anyone else in case it doesn't happen. Some part of him still thinks he's being set up to be a laughingstock. That part of him dies the moment he hears his name called. Minutes after Eric speaks his name, Jeremy Brown's phone begins to ring. First, it's family and friends, then agents. All these agents he's never heard of want to be in his life. Scott Boras suddenly wants to represent Jeremy Brown. The agents will tell him that they can get him at least $500,000 more than the A's have promised. He'll have to tell them that he's made a deal with the A's on his own and that he intends to keep his end of it. And he does. The next 2 hours are, to Billy Bean, a revelation. When the dust settles on the first 7 rounds, the A's have acquired 5 more of the hitters from Billy and Paul's wish list. Tian, Baker, Keeger, Stavisky, and Colamarino. When, in the 7th round, Eric leans in and takes this last of these, an ambidextrous first baseman from the University of Pittsburgh named Brant Colamarino, Paul wears an expression of pure bliss. "No one else in baseball will agree," he says, "but Colamarino might be the best hitter in the country." That told you how contrary the A's measuring devices were. They were able to draft possibly the best hitter in the country with the 218th pick of the draft. Then Paul says, "You know what gets me excited about a guy? I get excited about a guy when he has something about him that causes everyone else to overlook him, and I know that it is something that just doesn't matter." When Brant Colamarino removes his shirt for the first time in an A's minor league locker room, he inspires his coaches to inform Billy that Colamarino has titties. Colamarino, like Jeremy Brown, does not look the way a young baseball player is meant to look. Titties are one of those things that just don't matter in a ball player. Billy's only question for the coaches was whether a male brassiere should be called a man's ear or a bro. Most every other team looks at the market pretty much the same way, or at any rate, acts as if they do. Most teams, if they kept a wish list of 20 players, would feel blessed to have snagged 3 of them. The combination of having 7 first-round draft picks, a deeply quirky view of baseball players, and a general manager newly willing to impose that view on his scouting department has created something like a separate market in Oakland. From their wish list of 20, they had nabbed, incredibly, 13 players, 4 pitchers and 9 hitters. They had drafted players dismissed by their own scouts as too short or too skinny or too fat or too slow. They had drafted pitchers who didn't throw hard enough for the scouts and hitters who hadn't enough power. They drafted kids in the 1st round who didn't think they'd get drafted before the 15th round, and kids in lower rounds who didn't think they'd get drafted at all. They had drafted ball players. It was as if a big new market-moving Wall Street money manager had sprung into being and bought shares only in vegetarian restaurants or electric car manufacturers, with a difference. A revaluation in the stock market has consequences for companies and for money managers. The pieces of paper don't particularly care what you think of their intrinsic value. A revaluation in the market for baseball players resonates in the lives of young men. It was as if a signal had radiated out from the Oakland A's draft room and sought laser-like those guys who for their whole career had seen their accomplishments understood with an asterisk. The footnote at the bottom of the page said, "He'll never go anywhere because he doesn't look like a big league ball player." Billy Bean was a human arsenal, built inadvertently by professional baseball to attack its customs and rituals. He thought himself to be fighting a war against subjective judgments, but he was doing something else, too. At one point, Chris Pitaro said that the thing that struck him about Billy, what set him apart from most baseball insiders, was his desire to find players unlike himself. Billy Beane had gone looking for and found his antithesis. Young men who failed the first test of looking good in a uniform. Young men who couldn't play anything but baseball. Young men who had gone to college. The fat scout ambles in. He's one of the older scouts, and like most of the others, he'll leave the Oakland A's at the end of the season and find a team that cares about what he knows. All these misshapen players coming in will drive all of these old scouts out. But for now, they are all mainly amused. "Just talk to Keeger," the fat scout says, laconically. Mark Keeger plays shortstop for the University of Florida, a machine for wearing down opposing pitchers and getting himself on base. Too small to play pro ball, or so they said. Now a fifth-round draft choice of the Oakland A's. "What did he say?" asks Billy. "Thank you, thank you, thank you," says the fat scout, and then laughs. He just wanted to get drafted. It counted as one of the happiest days of Billy Beane's career. He can't have known whether he had simply found a new way of fixing irrational hopes upon a young man, or if he had, as he hoped, eliminated hope from the equation. But he thought he knew. At the end of the day, he actually looked up with a big smile and said, "This is maybe the funnest day I have ever had in baseball." Then he walked out the back door of the draft room and into the Coliseum. He had another, bigger missile to fire at the conventional wisdom of Major League Baseball. It was called the Oakland A's. Chapter 6. The Science of Winning an Unfair Game. There was no simple way to approach the problem that Billy Beane was trying to solve. It read like an extra credit question on an algebra quiz. You have $40 million to spend on 25 baseball players. Your opponent has already spent $140 million on its own 25 players and holds perhaps another $100 million in reserve. What do you do with your $40 million to avoid humiliating defeat? "What you don't do," said Billy, "is what the Yankees do. If we do what the Yankees do, we lose every time because they're doing it with three times more money than we are." A poor team couldn't afford to go out shopping for big league stars in the prime of their careers. It couldn't even afford to go out and buy averagely priced players. The average big league salary was $2.3 million. The average A's opening day salary was a bit less than $1.5 million. The poor team was forced to find bargains. Young players and whatever older guys the market had undervalued. It would seem highly unlikely, given the wage inflation in pro baseball over the past 25 years, that any established big league player was underpriced. If the market was even close to rational, all the real talent would have been bought up by the rich teams, and the Oakland A's wouldn't have stood a chance. Yet, they stood a chance. Why? Oddly enough, Major League Baseball had asked that very question in its own half-assed, incurious way. After the 1999 season, Major League Baseball had created something it called the Commissioner's Blue Ribbon Panel on Baseball Economics, whose job it was to produce a document called the Blue Ribbon Panel Report. Its stated purpose was to examine the question of whether baseball's current economic system has created a problem of competitive imbalance in the game. The baseball commissioner, Bud Selig, had invited four men of sound reputation. Former U.S. Senator George Mitchell, Yale President Richard Levin, the columnist George Will, and former chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker, to write a report on the economic inequalities in baseball. Selig owned maybe the most pathetic poor team in all of baseball, the Milwaukee Brewers. He no doubt wanted to believe that the Brewers' trouble was poverty, not stupidity. He had an obvious financial interest in the commission reaching the conclusion that players' salaries needed to be constrained and that rich teams should subsidize poor ones. He expressed this interest by trying to pad the Blue Ribbon Panel Commission with other owners of poor, pathetic baseball teams. But the four eminences objected to this transparent attempt to undermine their authority and Selig agreed that the owners would merely sit in the room, observing the eminences deliberate. It didn't matter. In July 2000, the panel did pretty much exactly what Bud Selig hoped it would do. Conclude that poor teams didn't stand a chance, that their hopelessness was bad for baseball, and that a way must be found to minimize the distinction between rich and poor teams. George Will, the conservative columnist, was, oddly enough, the most outspoken proponent of baseball socialism. One dramatic fact Will often used to incite alarm was that the ratio of the payrolls of the seven richest and seven poorest teams in baseball was 4-1, while in pro basketball it was 1.75-1, and in pro football, 1.5-1. Baseball was the major American sport in which money bought success, he said, and that was a crime against the game. When fans of the Brewers and the Royal Sox and the Devil Rays figured out that their teams existed only so that the New York Yankees might routinely pummel them, they would abandon the sport altogether. At stake was nothing less than the future of professional baseball. There was something to be said for these arguments, but there was also something to be said against them, and according to two people who watched the proceedings, only one commissioner was willing to say it, Paul Volcker. Volcker was also the only commissioner with a financial background. To the growing annoyance of the others, he kept asking two provocative questions. One, if poor teams were in such dire financial condition, why did rich guys keep paying higher prices to buy them? Two, if poor teams had no hope, how did the Oakland A's, with the second lowest payroll in all of baseball, win so many games? The owners didn't have a good answer to the first question, but to answer the second, they dragged in Billy Bean to explain himself. The odd thing was that the previous season, 1999, the A's had finished 87-75 and missed the playoffs. Still, they had improved dramatically from 1998, Billy's first year on the job, when they'd gone 74-88. And they were looking even stronger in 2000. Volcker smelled a rat. If results in pro baseball were so clearly determined by financial resources, how could there be even a single exception? How could a poor team improve so dramatically? Paul De Podesta wrote Billy Bean's presentation, and Billy flew off to New York to explain to Volcker why he was a fluke. He was happy to do it. He hadn't the slightest interest in stopping the Blue Ribbon panel from concluding that his life was unfair. He'd be delighted to see the cost of players constrained, or even better, the Yankees made to give him some of their money. When he got up before the panel, Billy flashed a slide up on the overhead projector. It read, Major League, movie about the hapless Cleveland Indians. In order to assemble a losing team, the owner distributes a list of players to be invited to spring training. The baseball executives say that most of these players are way past their prime. Fans see the list in the paper and remark, I've never even heard of half these guys. Our situation closely resembles the movie. When it suited his purposes, Billy could throw the best pity party this side of the Last Supper. He told the Blue Ribbon panel that the Oakland A's inability to afford famous stars meant that no matter how well the team performed, the fans stayed away, which was the opposite of the truth. All the A's marketing studies showed that the main thing fans cared about was winning. Win with nobodies and the fans showed up, and the nobodies became stars. Lose with stars and the fans stayed home, and the stars became nobodies. Assembling nobodies into a ruthlessly efficient machine for winning baseball games and watching them become stars was one of the pleasures of running a poor baseball team. Billy also told the Blue Ribbon panel that his inability to pay the going rate for baseball players meant that his success was likely to be ephemeral. It might have been what they wanted to hear, but it wasn't what he believed. What he believed was what Paul Volcker seemed to suspect, that the market for baseball players was so inefficient and the general grasp of sound baseball strategy so weak that superior management could still run circles around taller piles of cash. He then went out and created more evidence in support of his belief. Having won 87 games in 1999, the Oakland A's went on to win 91 games in 2000 and an astonishing 102 games in 2001 and made the playoffs both years. They weren't getting worse. They were getting better. The rapidly expanding difference between the size of everyone else's money pile and Oakland's had no apparent effect. Each year, the Oakland A's seemed more the financial underdog, and each year, they won more games. Maybe they were just lucky. Or maybe they knew something other people didn't. Maybe they were, as they privately thought, becoming more efficient. When in 2001, for the second year in a row, they lost to the Yankees in the fifth and deciding game of the playoffs, the Oakland front office was certain that theirs had been the better team and that it was the Yankees who had gotten lucky, and that the Yankees front office knew it, and that some fraction of the $120 million the Yankees had paid Jason Giambi after the 2001 playoffs to lure him away from the Oakland A's was to prevent him from ever again playing for the Oakland A's. At any rate, by the beginning of the 2002 season, the Oakland A's, by winning so much with so little, had become something of an embarrassment to Bud Selig and, by extension, Major League Baseball. An aberration is what the baseball commissioner and the people who worked for him called the team, and when you asked them what they meant by that nebulous word, they said, though not for attribution, they've been lucky. This was the year the luck of the A's was meant to run out. The relative size of the team's payroll had shrunk yet again. The difference between the Yankees and A's opening day payrolls had ballooned from $62 million in 1999 to $90 million in 2002. The Blue Ribbon Panel's nightmare scenario for poor teams had become a reality for the 2002 Oakland A's. They had lost to free agency, and thus to richer teams, three of their proven stars, Jason Isringhausen, Johnny Damon, and Giambi. To a financial determinist like Bud Selig, the wonder must have been that they hadn't simply given up. Of course, no one in pro sports ever admits to quitting. But it was perfectly possible to abandon all hope of winning and at the same time show up every day for work to collect a paycheck. Professional sports had a word for this. Rebuilding. That's what half a dozen big league teams did more or less all the time. The Kansas City Royals had been rebuilding for the past 4 or 5 years. Bud Selig's Brewers had been taking a dive for at least a decade. The A's didn't do this for the simple reason that they actually believed they were going to keep on winning. Perhaps not so many games as they had in 2001, but enough to get themselves back to the playoffs. Before the 2002 season, Paul DePodesta had reduced the coming 6 months to a math problem. He judged how many wins it would take to make the playoffs. 95. He then calculated how many more runs the Oakland A's would need to score than they allowed to win 95 games. 135. The idea that there was a stable relationship between season run totals and season wins was another Jamesian discovery. Then, using the A's players' past performance as a guide, he made reasoned arguments about how many runs they would actually score and allow. If they didn't suffer an abnormally large number of injuries, he said, the team would score between 800 and 820 runs and give up between 650 and 670 runs. They wound up scoring 800 and allowing 653. From that, he predicted the team would win between 93 and 97 games and probably wind up in the playoffs. There aren't a lot of teams that win 95 games and don't make it to the playoffs, he said. If we win 95 games and don't make the playoffs, we're fine with that. The 2001 Oakland A's had won 102 regular season games. The 2002 Oakland A's entered the season without the three players widely regarded by the market to be their best, and the expected result was a net loss of 7 wins. How could that be? The only way to understand the math was to look a bit more closely at what exactly the team lost, or believed they lost, when other, richer teams hired away each of the three stars. The first and easiest player to understand was their old, flame-throwing closer, Jason Isringhausen. When Billy Beane had traded for him in the middle of the 1999 season, Isringhausen was pitching in the minor leagues with the New York Mets. To get him and a more expensive pitcher named Greg McMichael and the money to pay McMichael's salary, all Billy Beane had given up was his own established closer, Billy Taylor. Taylor, who ceased to be an effective pitcher more or less immediately upon joining the Mets, Billy Beane had himself plucked from the minor leagues for a few thousand dollars a few years earlier. The central insight that led him both to turn minor league nobodies into successful big league closers and to refuse to pay them the many millions a year they demanded once they became free agents, was that it was more efficient to create a closer than to buy one. Established closers were systematically overpriced, in large part because of the statistic by which closers were judged in the marketplace. Saves. The very word made the guy who achieved them sound vitally important, but the situation typically described by the save, the bases empty in the ninth inning with the team leading, was clearly far less critical than a lot of other situations pitchers faced. The closer's statistic did not have the power of language. It was just a number. You could take a slightly above-average pitcher and drop him into the closer's role, let him accumulate some gaudy number of saves, and then sell him off. You could, in essence, buy a stock, pump it up with false publicity, and sell it off for much more than you'd paid for it. Billy Beane had already done it twice and assumed he could do so over and over again. Jason Isringhausen's departure wasn't a loss to the Oakland A's, but a happy consequence of a money machine known as selling the closer. In return for losing Isringhausen to the St. Louis Cardinals, the A's had received two new assets. The Cardinals' first-round draft pick, along with a first-round compensation pick. The former they'd used to draft Benjamin Fritz, a pitcher they judged to have a brighter and cheaper future than Isringhausen. The latter, to acquire Jeremy Brown. The Blue Ribbon Commission had asked the wrong question. The question wasn't whether a baseball team could keep its stars even after they had finished with their 6 years of indentured servitude and became free agents. The question was, how did a baseball team find stars in the first place, and could it find new ones to replace the old ones it lost? How fungible were baseball players? The short answer was, a lot more fungible than the people who ran baseball teams believed. Finding pitchers who could become successful closers wasn't all that difficult. To fill the hole at the back of his bullpen, Billy had traded to the Toronto Blue Jays a minor league third baseman, Eric Hinsky, for Billy Koch, another crude fireballer. He knew that Hinsky was very good. He'd wind up being voted 2002 Rookie of the Year in the American League, but the Oakland A's already had an even better third baseman, Eric Chavez. Plus, Billy knew that, barring some disaster, Koch, too, would gain a lot of value as an asset. Koch would get his saves and be perceived by other teams to be a much more critical piece of a successful team than he actually was, whereupon the A's would trade him for something cheaper, younger, and possibly even better. The loss of Johnny Damon, the A's former center fielder, presented a different sort of problem. When Damon signed with Boston, the A's took the Red Sox's first-round pick to select Nick Swisher, plus a compensation pick. But Damon left two glaring holes, on defense in center field, on offense in the leadoff spot. Of the two, the offense was the easiest to understand and dismiss. When fans watched Damon, they saw the sort of thrilling leadoff hitter that a team simply had to have if it wanted to be competitive. When the A's front office watched Damon, they saw something else, an imperfect understanding of where runs come from. Paul De Podesta had been hired by Billy Beane before the 1999 season, but well before that he had studied the question of why teams win. Not long after he'd graduated from Harvard in the mid-90s, he'd plugged the statistics of every baseball team from the 20th century into an equation and tested which of them correlated most closely with winning percentage. He'd found only two, both offensive statistics, inextricably linked to baseball success. On-base percentage and slugging percentage. Everything else was far less important. Not long after he arrived in Oakland, Paul asked himself a question. What was the relative importance of on-base and slugging percentage? His answer began with a thought experiment. If a team had an on-base percentage of 1,000, that is, every hitter got on base, how many runs would it score? An infinite number of runs, since the team would never make an out. If a team had a slugging percentage of 1,000, meaning it gained a base for each hitter that came to the plate, how many runs would it score? That depended on how it was achieved, but it would typically be a lot less than an infinite number. A team might send 4 hitters to the plate in an inning, for instance. The first man hits a home run, the next 3 make outs. 4 plate appearances have produced 4 total bases and thus a slugging percentage of 1,000, and yet it had scored only 1 run in the inning. These percentages are designed to drive anyone who thinks twice about them mad. It's one thing to give 110% for the team, but it is another to get on base 1,000% of the time. On base percentage is actually on base per 1,000. A batter who gets on base 4 out of 10 times has an on base percentage of 400. Slugging percentage is even more mind-bending, as it is actually per 4,000. A perfect slugging percentage, achieved by hitting a home run every time, is 4,000. 4 bases for every plate appearance. But for practical purposes, on base and slugging are assumed to be measured on identical scales. At any rate, the majority of big league players have on-base percentages between 300 and 400, and slugging percentages between 400 and 600. Baseball fans and announcers were just then getting around to the Jamesian obsession with on-base and slugging percentages. The game slowly was turning its attention to the new statistic, OPS, on-base plus slugging. OPS was the simple addition of on-base and slugging percentages. Crude as it was a much better indicator than any other offensive statistic of the number of runs a team would score. Simply adding the two statistics together, however, implied they were of equal importance. If the goal was to raise a team's OPS, an extra percentage point of on-base was as good as an extra percentage point of slugging. Before his thought experiment, Paul had felt uneasy with this crude assumption. Now he saw that the assumption was absurd. An extra point of on-base percentage was clearly more valuable than an extra point of slugging percentage. But by how much? He proceeded to tinker with his own version of Bill James's runs created formula. When he was finished, he had a model for predicting run production that was more accurate than any he knew of. In his model, an extra point of on-base percentage was worth 3 times an extra point of slugging percentage. Paul's argument was radical even by sabermetric standards. Bill James and others had stressed the importance of on-base percentage, but even they didn't think it was worth 3 times as much as slugging. Most offensive models assumed that an extra point of on-base percentage as worth at most 1.5 times an extra point of slugging percentage. In Major League Baseball itself, where on-base percentage was not nearly so highly valued as it was by sabermetricians, Paul's argument was practically heresy. Paul walked across the hall from his office and laid out his argument to Billy Bean, who thought it was the best argument he had heard in a long time. Heresy was good. Heresy meant opportunity. A player's ability to get on base, especially when he got on base in unspectacular ways, tended to be dramatically underpriced in relation to other abilities. Never mind fielding skills and foot speed. The ability to get on base, to avoid making outs, was underpriced compared to the ability to hit with power. The one attribute most critical to the success of a baseball team was an attribute they could afford to buy. At that moment, what had been a far more than ordinary interest in a player's ability to get on base became, for the Oakland A's front office, an obsession. To most of baseball, Johnny Damon, on offense, was an extraordinarily valuable leadoff hitter with a gift for stealing bases. To Billy Bean and Paul DePodesta, Damon was a delightful human being, a pleasure to have around, but an easily replaceable offensive player. His on-base percentage in 2001 had been .324, or roughly 10 points below the league average. True, he stole some bases, but stealing bases involved taking a risk the Oakland front office did not trust even Johnny Damon to take. The math of the matter changed with the situation, but broadly speaking, an attempted steal had to succeed about 70% of the time before it contributed positively to run totals. The offense Damon had provided the 2001 Oakland A's was fairly easy to replace. Damon's defense was not. The question was how to measure what the Oakland A's lost when Terrence Long, and not Johnny Damon, played center field. The short answer was that they couldn't, not precisely. But they could get closer than most to an accurate answer, or thought that they could. Something had happened since Bill James first complained about the meaninglessness of fielding statistics. That something was new information and a new way of thinking about an old problem. Oddly, the impulse to do this thinking had arisen on Wall Street. In the early 1980s, the U.S. financial markets underwent an astonishing transformation. A combination of computing power and intellectual progress led to the creation of whole new markets in financial futures and options. Options and futures were really just fragments of stocks and bonds, but the fragments soon became so arcane and inexplicable that Wall Street created a single word to describe them all: derivatives. In one big way, these new securities differed from traditional stocks and bonds. They had a certain, precisely quantifiable value. It was impossible for anyone to say what a simple stock or bond should be worth. Their value was a matter of financial opinion. They were worth whatever the market said they were worth. But fragments of a stock or bond, when you glued them together, must be worth exactly what the stock or bond was worth. If they were worth more or less than the original article, the market was said to be inefficient, and a trader could make a fortune trading the fragments against the original. For the better part of a decade, there were huge, virtually riskless profits to be made by people who figured this out. The sort of people who quickly grasped the math of the matter were not typical traders. They were highly trained mathematicians and statisticians and scientists who had abandoned whatever they were doing at Harvard or Stanford or MIT to make a killing on Wall Street. The fantastic sums of money hauled in by the sophisticated traders transformed the culture on Wall Street and made quantitative analysis, as opposed to gut feel, the respectable way to go about making bets in the market. The chief economic consequence of the creation of derivative securities was to price risk more accurately and distribute it more efficiently than ever before in the long, risk-obsessed history of financial man. The chief social consequence was to hammer into the minds of a generation of extremely ambitious people a new connection between inefficiency and opportunity, and to reinforce an older one between brains and money. Ken Mariello and Jack Armbruster had been part of that generation. Ken analyzed the value of derivative securities, and Jack traded them for one of the more profitable Chicago trading firms. Their firm priced financial risk as finely as it had ever been priced. In the late 1980s, Kenny started looking at taking the same approach to Major League Baseball players, said Armbruster. Looking at the places where the stats don't tell the whole truth, or even lie about the situation. Mariello and Armbruster's goal was to value the events that occurred on a baseball field more accurately than they ever had been valued. In 1994, they stopped analyzing derivatives and formed a company to analyze baseball players called AVM Systems. Ken Mariello had seen a connection between the new complex financial markets and baseball, the inefficiency caused by sloppy data. As Bill James had shown, baseball data conflated luck and skill and simply ignored a lot of what happened during a baseball game. With two outs and a runner on second base, a pitcher makes a great pitch. The batter hits a bloop into left field that would have been caught had the left fielder not been Albert Bell. The shrewd runner at second base, knowing that Albert Bell is slow not just to the ball but also to the plate, beats the throw home. In the record books, the batter was credited with having succeeded, the pitcher with having failed, and the left fielder and the runner with having been present on the scene. This was a grotesque failure of justice. The pitcher and runner deserve to have their accounts credited, the batter and left fielder to have theirs debited. The former should have popped out. The latter somehow had avoided committing an error and at the same time put runs on the board for the other team. There was hardly a play in baseball that, to be precisely valued, didn't need to be adjusted for the players involved, or the ballpark in which it occurred. What AVM's system really wanted to know was, in every event that occurs on a baseball field, how and how much should the players involved be held responsible, and therefore debited and credited? Answer the question, and you could answer many others. For example, how many doubles does Albert Bell need to hit to make up for the fly balls he doesn't catch? How to account for a player's performance was obvious. Runs. Runs were the money of baseball, the common denominator of everything that occurred on a field. How much each tiny event on a baseball field was worth was a more complicated issue. AVM dealt with it by collecting 10 years of data from Major League Baseball games, of every ball that was put into play. Every event that followed a ball being put into play was compared by the system to what had typically happened during the previous 10 years. No matter what happens in a baseball game, said Armbruster, it has happened thousands of times before. The performance of the players involved was always judged against the average. A lot of this was no different from what Bill James and Dick Kramer had set out to do 10 years earlier when they created Stats, Inc. The original contribution to new baseball knowledge of AVM systems was how much more precisely it analyzed data and how much more exactly it valued the performances of the players. Moriello and Armbruster began by turning every major league diamond into a mathematical matrix of location points. Every point they marked with a number. They then reclassified every ball that was hit. There was no such thing in their record as a double. That was too sloppy. There was no such thing as pop flies, line drives, and grounders. Finer distinctions needed to be made. A ball was hit with a certain velocity and trajectory to a certain grid on the field. In the AVM recording of a baseball game, a line drive double in the left center gap became a ball hit with a certain force that landed on point number 643. The system then carved up what happened in every baseball play into countless tiny, meaningful fragments. Derivatives. There are all sorts of things that happen in the context of a baseball play, said Armbruster, that just never got recorded. A tiny example. After a single to right field, a runner who had been on first base, seeing that Raul Mondesi is the right fielder, stops at second base instead of dashing to third. Runners seldom tried to go from first to third on balls hit to right field when Raul Mondesi was playing there. That was obviously worth something. What? Just as it never occurred to anyone on Wall Street to think about the value of pieces of a stock or a bond until there was a pile of money to be made from the exercise, it never occurred to anyone in the market for baseball players to assign values to the minute components of a baseball player's performance, until baseball players became breathtakingly expensive. Bill James's work had been all about challenging the traditional understanding of the game by questioning the meaning of its statistics. The financial experts at AVM took this idea even further by recording the events that occurred on a baseball field without any reference whatsoever to the traditional statistics. It wasn't just circumstantial statistics such as RBI and saves that the AVM model ignored. It ignored all conventional baseball statistics. The system replaced the game seen by the ordinary fan with an abstraction. In AVM's computers, the game became a collection of derivatives, a parallel world in which baseball players could be evaluated more accurately than they were evaluated in the real world. Paul DePodesta was an intern for the Cleveland Indians when he first met the former Wall Street traders turned baseball analysts, making their first sales trip around Major League Baseball. He remembers his reaction to their presentation. Oh my God. It opened my eyes for me, said Paul. The biggest thing that AVM does is extract the element of luck. Everyone in baseball knows how much luck is involved in the game, but they all say the luck evens out. What AVM was saying is that it doesn't. It's not good enough to say, "Oh, it just evens out." An insight born in the financial markets took root in the mind of a young man who would soon have the power to put it to use inside Major League Baseball. Not long after Billy Bean had hired Paul DePodesta in 1998, Paul persuaded Billy to hire AVM Systems. "They were still interesting to me," Paul said, "because they weren't churning conventional statistics in unconventional ways, which is what everyone else does." AVM Systems was a luxury only a rich team could afford, but that only a poor team, desperate for any edge, would think to use. Billy and Paul used the AVM system for a couple of years and then, to save money, copied what AVM did. Once Paul finished replicating the parallel world of derivatives, he and Billy could begin to answer more accurately the question about Johnny Damon's defense. Every event on a baseball field, Paul understood as having an expected run value. You don't need to be able to calculate expected run values to understand them. Everything that happens on a baseball field alters, often very subtly, a team's chances of scoring runs. Every event on a baseball field changes, often imperceptibly, the state of the game. For example, the value of having no runners on base and no count on the batter is roughly 0.55 runs, because that is what a baseball team, on average, will score in that situation. If the batter smacks a double, he changes the state of the game. It's now nobody out with a runner on second base. The expected run value of that new state is 1.1 runs. It follows that the contribution of a leadoff double to a team's expected runs is 0.55 runs, 1.1 minus 0.55. If the batter, instead of hitting a double, strikes out, he lowers the team's expected run value to roughly 0.30 runs. The cost of making that out was therefore 0.25 runs, the difference between the value of the original state of the game and the state the batter left it in. But those calculations really only scratch the surface of the problem. If you want to strip out the luck and get to a deeper understanding of the value of a player's performance, you have to pose the baseball equivalent of existential questions. For instance, what is a double? It really isn't enough to say that a double is when a runner hits a ball and gets to second base without a fielder's error. Anyone who has seen a baseball game knows that all doubles are not alike. There are doubles that should have been caught, just as there are balls that are hit that should have been doubles but were plucked from the air by preternaturally gifted fielders. There are lucky doubles and unlucky outs. To strip out the luck, what you need really is something like a platonic idea of a double. A set of platonic ideas is one of the gifts the Wall Street traders gave to Paul DePodesta. The precision of the AVM system, copied by Paul, enabled him to think about every event that occurred on a baseball field in a new and more satisfying way. Any ball hit any place on a baseball field had been hit just that way thousands of times before. The average of all those hits was the platonic idea. Call it a line drive hit at X trajectory and Y speed to point number 968. From the 10 years' worth of data, you can see that there have been 8,642 practically identical hits. You can see that 92% of the time the hit went for a double, 4% for a single, and 4% it was caught. Suppose the average value of that event is 0.50 of a run. No matter what actually happened, the system credits the hitter with having generated 0.50 of a run, and the pitcher with having given up 0.50 of a run. If Johnny Damon happens to get one of his trademark jumps and makes a sprawling catch, he is credited with saving his team 0.50 of a run. The beauty of the value of that hit, or catch, was that the game gave it to you. The game told you how valuable every event was by telling you how valuable it had been on average over the past 10 years. By listening to what the game told him about the value of events, Paul could take every ball hit in the area broadly defined as center field and determine its expected run value. Which brings us back to Johnny Damon. Over the 2001 season, many hundreds of balls had been hit by opponents of the Oakland A's in the vicinity typically covered by the center fielder. By totaling up the out